sit back and get ready to take off with Dynamic Golf. Fellow podcast listeners, I'm your co-host, Tim McElvanna, and with me is my fellow partner, Sean Klotz. Sean, who do we have today?
T-Mac, we've got a very special gentleman. He's the club historian for the golf course. His name is Dan Mee. Member, Dan, how long have you been a member at Oakley?
31 years.
31 years. Yeah. Great. That's unbelievable. And the club historian, is that like a position that changes throughout? Do different people have it, or is that technically the name of the title too, I guess should be the way to say it? Or have you just taken it on yourself to start recording stuff?
Certainly, yeah. A lot of self-appointed historians out there, but yeah. Many clubs have a club historian.
Okay.
It's not uncommon at all, and in fact, the Ross clubs in particular have a tendency to have a designated historian.
Okay.
The Donald Ross Society does a very good job of knitting us all together, and we have a special web page on their web page.
Okay.
Historians, so we can communicate with each other.
Yeah.
Oakley has had a great deal of interest in its history over the years. There was a fellow named Witcher back in the 30s who researched the original clubhouse and determined that it was, in fact, designed by Charles Bullfinch. And it was rare for Bullfinch to do a suburban commission. The plans for that clubhouse are actually in the Library of Congress, along with Monticello and Mount Vernon. I mean, it was a very important building.
Yep.
After him, there was a fellow named Reynolds that wrote the history in 1948 for the 50th anniversary. And there were other people that stepped in and did some work. When I joined the club, there was a fellow named Dr. Dan Shea, and he was the club historian then, and he did most of the research that resulted in the book we delivered in 1998 for the anniversary of the club moving here to Strawberry Hill. I'm reticent to say that it's the centennial of our founding, because what we established in the most recent history book is that we were in fact founded in 1895.
The Cambridge Golf Club, is that
Cambridge
right?
Golf Club.
Yeah.
And wow. And then moved across the street, basically moved across Mount Auburn Street to this property,
mm-hmm.
and initially called ourselves the Cambridge Golf and Country Club,
yeah.
and then changed that to Oakley, I think as part of a whole celebration of the new course and the new clubhouse.
Right. And the estate, Tim, the Oakley was actually an estate of one of the previous, like, landowners, essentially, right? Like, the Harrison Gray Otis, his...
Right, so that's the house that was designed by Bullfinch, who was a buddy of Otis. Otis was a big real estate developer in downtown Boston, basically built most of Beacon Hill.
Oh, wow.
And he has a grand house. It's still there on Cambridge Street. It's a museum now.
Yeah.
Wow.
So Otis was an owner, and he sold his house to the Pratt family in, I think, 1825 or 30, mm-hmm. and the club bought the property from the Pratt family.
Okay.
So there's a direct line there.
Yeah.
And what's interesting for anybody who plays Oakley today, you know, we're a 6,000 yard course, and by today's standards, pretty modest. But Oakley is the first 18-hole course ever built in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts. It's the second 18-hole course in New England after Newport. And it was so important because our first course was a 9-hole course down on Mount Auburn Street. As I said, we moved across and we laid out 18. And the fellow that designed that first course was Willie Campbell, who was a very impressive fellow. Surprised not more is written about Willie. He's a really an interesting character. But, I mean, he expanded the country club from 6 to 9. He laid out 9 nines at Essex in Myopia, in Wollaston, in Franklin Park, which is the second public course in the country. Willie was prolific in Scotland before he came out.
the country club too, didn't he do?
He expanded the country club from 6 to 9.
Okay.
And then he was the pro there for a bit.
Okay.
And then he was the pro up at Myopia for a bit.
Tim, wow. For our listeners, these every golf course Dan just mentioned is, you know, top 100 in America and probably top 10 in the state, I would say. Myopia, Essex, and the country club in Oakley, and the list goes on, Winchester, and we'll get to some of the more than
yeah,
ones.
Yeah, definitely
did,
a who's who's story. List right there going on for sure.
We're not,
yes,
we're not talking about the local munis in Florida or whatever or anywhere. But
yeah.
Anyways, but he did municipal golf courses for the record too, which we can get to some of the public ones.
Yeah, there could be a whole story of Willie Campbell.
Yeah,
and his wife. His wife was the first golf professional in the United States.
Oh, wow.
Female golf professional.
Interesting.
So.
He got sick, right?
Yeah,
died basically.
Yeah. Good, Sean. You're absolutely right, and that's what many people that are interested in Ross always kind of reach out to us and say, "Well, how'd this happen?" I mean, because he was certainly, and it's if you go back and look what he did in Scotland, he was a pretty young guy. He was a great golfer. His dad was a stonemason, and Ross didn't want to do that. He started as a joiner, which I guess is a type of carpenter, and he didn't like that. But he loved golf, and he got close with the people at Dornick, and they wanted to hire him, but he didn't have any training, so he went off to St. Andrews and trained under old Tom. And then he went to Carnoustie and trained under another great guy, and then he learned club making from one of the finest club makers of the time down at Tennessee. And then he came back to Dornick, and he was their first professional. They didn't have a professional before him.
Wow. And he was only 27 when he came here. So, Sam, everything Dan just mentioned happened before he was 27 years old.
It's amazing.
Right?
Yeah, and comes to a new country at the age of 27. You know, that's pretty stout stuff.
He got recruited by one of the board members.
Mm-hmm. It didn't happen by accident.
No.
No.
But before we talk about that, I think it's important to understand that Ross had a great life. I mean, he had this just awesome job, his dream job.
Yeah.
And in those days, the pro wore a lot of hats, so, you know, he was given lessons. But, you know, he's taking care of the grounds and learning. He had learned about groundskeeping for old Tom. But it was a big job in that town, and he was the guy.
Yeah.
And he just got engaged. And so there's a lot of things holding him there, including his parents, who he's very close to.
Right.
Yeah.
But anyway, in the summer of 1898, one of our board members, Robert Wheeler Wilson, two L's on Wilson.
The Harvard professor.
Yeah.
Right.
He was. He worked in two disciplines, astronomy. In physics.
Unbelievable.
And we actually have Wilson's picture on the wall of this boardroom here.
Nice.
So Wilson was there with his wife, and they took lessons from Ross, and he was so impressed. He asked him, "What do you make?" And Ross told him, and he goes, "Man, you can make three times that in America." And so Ross kind of was shocked. That was the first time he heard there was that kind of money in golf. And then Wilson went off. But Wilson never forgot that conversation or Ross. And when he got back to Boston, he told the board about it. And the growing club here at Oakley needed people to teach.
Right.
And so we had another member, Alfred Ripley, who was head of the golf committee. He wrote Ross and made an offer of employment. And Ross came, and he came in March of 1899, and if you read his story, Golf Never Failed Me, he goes into it in some detail. The poor guy spent everything he had to get here, and he had precious few pennies in his pocket, and he walked from South State, because he went to New York instead of Boston. I don't know if he got a deal or got on the wrong boat.
Wow.
In New York, had to take a train to Boston.
Yeah.
And then he gets to South Station, and he's like almost broke, and calls up Wilson. And it might strike you funny that Wilson had a phone in that 1899, but there were a lot of connections to Bell Telephone at Oakley, including our president at the time, Charles Eustace Hubbard, who was a founder and a longtime board member of Bell Telephone. His nephew was Alexander Graham Bell.
Okay.
I bring it up because
it's crazy.
I've read so many things about this period, and people just say, there's no way he had a phone. And I'm like, whatever. Right. But there's a lot of reasons why Wilson and probably everybody else had a phone. So he got to Wilson's house, and he stayed with Wilson because he had no place to stay.
Okay.
Now, that first struck me kind of funny. You know, this Wilson was a really high society guy, and, right. and poor Ross, on the manifest of the Majestic, the ship he took out, I think he listed his occupation as servant.
And golf instructor, right? Because it's downstairs in the Ross Library.
Yeah.
I read that.
That's
oh, wow.
It's perfect.
Yeah.
But it's so humble, right?
Yeah, yeah he didn't.
And he didn't, but here is this real society guy, and I'm saying he stayed with him.
Right.
But then you realize in those days, most middle and upper class people had servants,
mm-hmm.
and they had a servant's quarters.
Mm-hmm.
So it was nothing to him for him to have Ross stay there for a couple of days till he got squared away. And then he ended up getting a boarding house. That's virtually all Oakley staff that in the census of 1900 all list their occupation as a servant.
Okay.
So Ross comes out, and Oakley is, there's a Campbell course there, 18 holes. I've read that there was only 12 holes there. I mean, a lot of golf writers read something but don't confirm it.
Okay.
And so it gets repeated and repeated. But we have confirmed that there were 18 holes here, all designed by Willie Campbell. It's a short course, 5,200 yards. But it was 18, and you've got to remember in 1898,
ball doesn't go as far.
Yeah,
right. Well, there was clubs, part of that.
Yeah, clubs don't go. Yeah,
absolutely.
No
part
titanium
of it.
Drivers and graphite shafts.
1898 was the last U.S. Open played on nine holes.
Okay,
and it was the first U.S. Open that had, I think, 72 players.
Oh, okay.
And so, and it was played up at Myopia.
Yep,
and it was not fun. I mean, guys are coming off the into a rhythm, and all of a sudden they got to wait.
Really?
They just got the one course.
Oh, that's
and it just emphasized why the nine-hole courses were inadequate.
Yeah.
And Oakley recognized that, and we were the first to do it.
Yeah.
So a year or two later that the country club put theirs in. But it's interesting. If you look at 1900 and you look at the courses in Massachusetts, 85% of them are nine. There's a smattering of sixes, which is fascinating. You go around three times.
Okay.
That's interesting.
And then there are a handful of 18s by 1900.
So he came over as basically, like you said, servant, kind of like golf instructor was his title, essentially, right? And club repair he did. But then didn't the board members, or they essentially, he was tending to the green side of it. Like he started... Because Campbell got sick, so he started kind of...
Well, Campbell was never the groundskeeper here.
Okay, he just...
He designed it, and he was the groundskeeper at Franklin Park.
Okay.
With his wife.
Okay.
And so the course was designed, the trees were cut, it was here, but it needed a lot of work.
Yeah.
I mean, they take a long time to grow,
and
the grass was still growing in.
Yeah.
Although they were playing on it pretty regularly by the fall of 1898.
Yeah.
So anyway... Ross was given the job to try to repair this thing.
Right.
Okay.
And as I mentioned, it was a short course. It was a 5,200.
Yeah.
And the club always envisioned a much bigger course.
Mm-hmm.
And we owned most of that land, and we leased some of it.
Hmm.
And then we were able to buy another 17 acres in 1899.
Which is the Strawberry Hill part of it?
Well, we're on Strawberry Hill now.
That's
and
the highest point.
This was part of the Payson Estate, which was next door.
Okay.
The other side of the wall.
Hey, Mac, I've tried to show you guys pictures. We'll do more on YouTube, but we're at the highest point in Watertown. You know, so when you're in 1900 Boston, there's no skyscrapers. You're just basically seeing the ocean. like the view was out to the Atlantic.
Yeah, that's what I was reading, is that you just had a beautiful, uphill view up there looking down at everything. So it's got to be a gorgeous view, or, you know, I'm sure before some of the high rises came in, but I'm sure it was a gorgeous view prior to that.
Tim, that's exactly right. And I've read that some of the old residents would just sit on the veranda and watch the tall ships come into the harbor, because there's just nothing blocking your view,
right?
We can no longer see the Atlantic, but
yeah.
It's not too hard to understand that they could.
Oh my gosh, that's amazing. Tall ships is a different podcast, to the record. That's amazing. That's part of the Boston history. We won't go into tea party stuff, but it's kind of in the same realm.
That's amazing. Anyways, that's a rich history right there in itself.
We get the extra land, and it was clear you had to rework the whole course, because Campbell's course had a lot of very short holes.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
And, for example, our current fifth hole, there were two holes in that one corridor.
Oh, wow.
It did the job. You had 18 holes, but it wasn't optimal, and they always knew they were going to expand it.
Yeah.
And there were a lot of candidates. There were the Stearns Estate south of us and the Payson Estate west of that initial property. Their ownership was either already dead or really old.
Okay.
And so the membership thought, we're going to get one of those properties.
Okay.
So they got the first chunk of the Payson Estate, and there's no record of it. Our guess is they would have contacted Campbell, because he was the premier designer.
Right.
But Willie was very sick, and as you guys mentioned earlier, and wasn't up to it.
Yeah.
He never played another match in 1899, and then So
kind of turned to Ross, essentially, right?
They did, and so Dr. Healy, who was the lead author on our book, he and I would wrestle with this topic. Why Ross? There were a lot of really good designers in Boston.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
And, we've come to the conclusion that Ross just must have impressed people at such a level, with his knowledge, with his work ethic. Hmm. And he was in the perfect position, right? So he's out there working. The course is starting to look nice. But then he's given these people lessons.
Right.
And he's given the board members lessons. I mean, he's just wired in.
He got Wilson out. I mean, right? The Wilson connection.
And Wilson's his man.
Right,
but
right.
This fellow, Dana, he's on the wall. He was his man. And they just in that era when you really had a master-servant relationship with staff.
Okay, yeah.
He transcended that. Mm-hmm. I mean, the members of Oakley especially really looked at him. It may sound crazy, but I believe they looked at him as a peer.
Okay. Yeah.
And they really developed long friendships that lasted his life. And right. There's a letter in our Ross Library that speaks to that.
Okay.
He really enjoyed his time here. Anyway, they turned to the new kid. And I jokingly said to Dr. Healy, well, if you look at photographs of Campbell and Ross in that era, mm-hmm. They both had mustaches. They didn't look dissimilar. They sounded the same, right? They're both from Scotland.
Okay.
So now, he's the guy. We'll let him do it.
Yeah.
And that was it. That's how he got the start. And he laid out a new 18. He actually did two different designs.
Okay.
And the board picked one of them, and then they built it. And so that was his first commission.
Right.
He was paid a couple of $1,000s. He sent most of that home to his mother. And she added a floor to the family cottage on St. Gilbert Street and renamed it the Oakley Cottage.
Right? Yeah. That's a cool part of it.
That's Sean, beautiful.
We started researching this, and I'm saying, so many people belong to a country club, and it's just functional. All right, I just want the course to play well.
Yeah.
But mm-hmm. there's this whole other side to this place that's fascinating, and it's not it doesn't interest everybody, but it interests enough of us that it's important to preserve it. Many people, there are probably more than a handful of members that still just think we're another Ross course. Mm-hmm. It's really not that important. The fact that our super Pat Lang keeps it playing so well, that's the really important thing for them. But this, for a little golf course, it really punches above its weight when you talk about golf history.
Right.
Yeah.
Because when Ross was here, he was such an innovator.
He did like a water, like he brought water from.
Our greens were irrigated in 1900. Nobody's greens were irrigated in 1900.
That. Right.
And today we're still finding some of the old metal pipes out there that are corroded. I got to probably have one cut out and put it in.
Pretty funny.
The shelf. But he also had gave indoor lessons back then.
I did read that. No TrackMan, T-Mac. No TrackMan, but he's doing indoor lessons in 1900.
He was the TrackMan.
11 years. Yeah, so he's here from 1999 to 1910.
Right.
As the head pro, Tim. Yeah. And he's designing golf courses, did he design courses during that time? He played a lot. He was a really good player. I didn't realize.
Very few.
Yeah.
There's only a handful.
Or after the 19th.
But he and this is where I think a lot of people get confused. So he came here in 99, and he stayed. That was the only winter he spent in New England.
Okay. Okay.
And then that's probably when he put the nets and the squash courts and gave lessons.
So funny.
During 1900, he finished laying out this course and was giving lessons. And we had a member that was James Tufts' attorney.
Okay.
And Tufts, obviously, he had already started Pinehurst. There wasn't a lot of golf. I think he had won 9-hole course there, Pinehurst won.
Yep.
And his attorney said, no, you got to talk to this guy.
Wow.
So he set up a dinner over in Medford, and they hit it off.
Yep.
And so from the winter of 1900, in December, Ross went down to North Carolina, and that started the relationship. And so he was the winter pro in North Carolina, and he was the summer pro at Oakley. And right. Some of the matches that he played from there on in, it actually indicate those two positions.
Wow.
What's frustrating for us is that so many people will read that history and just say, oh, he was at Oakley for a year and then went to Pinehurst.
No.
When he was our full-time employee for 11 years.
Yeah. And Tim, they took July and August off, which I thought was interesting too, right? Because
good life. For
exactly.
life was different back then for sure, yes.
Closed down.
Yeah, because they basically went to their summer homes, we'll call it. That's what happened. Or, there's no air conditioning, mm-hmm. so they're going to go by the beaches or by the
Nantucket, or whatever it is.
Maine. Yeah. So just an interesting side note that as the summer pro, he's not working. He works May through June and then kind of comes back September through November type of thing? Or something.
There was always a big 4th of July event.
Okay.
And
okay.
So it kind of shut down right after the 4th of July. Go. And then would kick back in mid-September.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Cool down or whatever.
But this led to a lot of his commissions because members would scatter and then say, come up here to Mount Washington and design this this course on the hill.
Unbelievable.
Wow.
Great place. So he did Pinehurst number one, number two, and number three from the information we got. Tim, some of the I would really encourage our listeners to just because we can't do it justice here. But to go research a little bit of what Ross did over the next, because he died in 48, does that sound right?
Yeah.
Something like that. So from like kind of the 1910 to 1948 and what he did in America, I'll say, and Canada for the record, or I don't know, of course he made it.
In Cuba. He
did in Cuba too, yeah.
Oh, wow.
I mean, Florida, where you're at, T-Mac.
Bel Air Country Bobby Club Williams. and all those. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, there's,
Palmacia.
Yeah, Palmacia.
That's a staple in the Tampa area. That's that would be almost like an Oakley kind of feel in Tampa, meaning kind of like a little bit of working class, a little bit of old school money. you know, definitely the course to play because it's in the center of town, we'll call it.
Yep.
Small, you know, Palmasia is kind of a shorter golf course.
A decade-long waiting list to get in there.
Yeah, there you go, right? So, always in good shape type of stuff.
Beautiful. It's like going to, you know, it's a beautiful course for sure.
Yeah, and you were telling me, Dan, about you played Seminole, which is one of his designs, right?
Such a treat to get on that track. Many consider it as good as Pinehurst number 2 in terms of the whole list of Ross courses.
Did you ever play Dunedin, Tim?
No, I've never had the chance of playing Dunedin.
Dunedin Country Club, amazing golf course, and just, you know, basically north of Clearwater. Delray Beach, it sounds like Delray Beach Golf Course. I played that as like a municipal golf course that I didn't realize was built by Jones, but it's such a fun layout. I probably played it 20 years ago.
Uh-huh.
You know, Lake Wales Country Club is an old school golf course in Florida. Pelican, which they just redesigned, obviously, but Bellevue Biltmore. And Sarah Bay is the one I've always talked about with people down here. So that's just the Florida golf courses. And I didn't list the other 30 that you did in Florida, by the way. I just listed the ones that I know of that I've played.
He was prolific.
I mean, Connecticut Shinnecosset. You ever play that one?
I did not.
That's a great track. It's right on the water. It's in Groton. Great golf course. Rhode Island's got, I mean.
Oh, it's a long list.
He
lived in Rhode Island later.
Okay.
He moved around a bit. Now, again, this was Summers.
Yeah.
After he left Oakley in the end of 1910, and he just came back from playing in the British Open where he finished eighth, tied for eighth, but he was only one stroke off of being, there was a bunch of people tied it, and he would have been fourth.
Okay.
One stroke.
Yep.
So the guy could play. Yeah. But he never played competitively after that. In terms of a major.
Okay.
I mean, he'd always play in the North-South, but he never played in the U.S. Open or any.
He finished in the top 10 three times in the U.S. Open from like 19 to 1910, basically, right?
Yeah. During that period while he was here.
Yeah.
And he didn't play after that. He left here and he went to Essex for 3 years.
Because he got a house there, too.
And he lived on the property.
Wow.
And then, I mean, I think it was pretty clear in 1910 that He really didn't want to be a club pro.
Right.
He really liked designing courses.
Yeah.
And Oakley needed a full-time pro.
Okay.
So it seemed that it was very amicable, his move to Essex.
Okay.
A lot of Oakley members belonged to Essex.
Okay.
Oh.
And so he went up there for 3 years, and they were ecstatic with what he did.
Yeah.
And then he had this kind of bumper year where he was living in Newton and trying to build this this business. And he, I think he did 13 clubs designed in 1914. But Oakley gave him playing privileges here. And again, I talk about this guy transcended the servant master attitude in those days. That's almost unimaginable that you would give a former pro playing privileges at a private club.
Yeah.
It's kind of snooty, but that's just the reality of it.
That's so great.
When you dial that into you thinking about him, this is a special guy.
Yeah, he was viewed just by the membership as a different person, basically, not just, that's amazing.
I mean, it just seems like from the beginning of the story that I've heard so far is that the gentleman, Robert Wilson, definitely had to have seen something in him to have him come across, you know, try to bring him in there. He had to be a very... charismatic character for all these people to follow him. And I think it's just a great testament of his character and who he was. I'm sure he was a very fine character to have a chat with.
Tim, we talk about that a lot, like in the PGA world, right? We've talked about that as far as like us going through our PGA schooling and getting our Class A card. And that first time that I went to my PGA level one, and I talked about this even last week on my podcast, but when you walk into level one and the instructor has the sign up there, as you walk into the room of the responsibilities and duties of the club pro, and it's 35 mm-hmm. positions deep, you know, greenskeeper, golf cart fleet management, retailer, business guy, hey, can you play a little bit? Can you teach? Are you able to, read a P&L sheet? Can you do business? Like, It's amazing. It just shows you the origin for us now, and where we are.
And then throw on course designer on it, too. Go ahead and do that. On the side, just go ahead and design world-renowned designs.
Right. And the other part I want to bring up, too, with Dan here is, and Dan, like I said, I didn't know he was here for 31 years so far.
Amazing.
Is when you know, the whole reason I came to Massachusetts, me and Dan really haven't talked. I've been in Tampa for 35 years. One of the main reasons I came was because of Scott Johnson.
Yeah.
Right? And Scott Johnson's been here for 24 years. And if you look at the list of pros, professionals that you see on the wall, there's some long-standing. Yeah. Paul Donahue was he here? There's some guys who've been here for, you know, they're not just kind of two and out, is my point, Tim, right? These guys, they become kind of that, I'll use the term because Dan used it, sort of the master servant sort of role, but the membership views Scott as definitely kind of more of a, you know, a person on the same level, we'll call it. Yeah.
So what I find fascinating that even today, so many Scots, men that were born and trained in golf in Scotland, still outnumber the Americans that have been our pros. I think our last Scot was Fred Lowe.
Yeah. He was here for 22 years or 18 years.
Yeah. Right?
Yeah. I mean, Tim, again.
Usual in this business, right? Because you're bound to piss somebody off.
Exactly. That's what I'm saying. If I just read this, Tim, if I just read this from 1920 to 2024, okay, we've got 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 professionals in 104 years. That shows you the loyalty, first of all, of the membership at Oakley, and kind of the, you know, importance that the professional holds at the facility.
I think there's been more popes.
Right. There you go. Exactly. Exactly. And we got two Scottish guys, John Cowan and Fred Lowe. Paul Donahue was here for 31 years. Like, it's just amazing. It's really a good testament to the golf course, to the membership, to the board of directors, to the people who realize that, hey, once you get somebody good, you want to keep them. And then vice versa, from the employee side, I'll say it from Scott's side, once you get to a club where you do feel appreciated, might be the term, or, you know, like, you know, that you want to stay. And that's a great way for both sides. It keeps the continuity of the tournaments and the operation going.
No doubt.
Yeah.
The other thing I love about this facility is that, you know, just not the rich history that you guys have with Donald Ross and his history. I mean, you guys have a rich history with presidents being on the property, Bobby Jones being on the property, Women's Amateur Association, and how big of a role that Oakley has played in that. I mean, it's huge. I mean, it's just like Dan said, it's definitely hitting above its weight, and it's a huge history. It's a rich history you guys have there. It's amazing.
What I've been impressed with, Tim, is that the membership has taken such care of this course. Yeah. If you look at the grounds professionals that they've allowed to come in and consult, or the people that have actually worked on this course, it's a who's who.
Okay.
I mean, it starts obviously with Willie Campbell, and he hands off to Roth. In the 30s, Tilly House comes in here, right?
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, wow. That's a conversation itself, too.
We have a whole report that he wrote on the course.
For our listeners, Tillinghast did Augusta Masters, right? Like with Bobby Jones? Is that,
no, that was McKenzie.
Oh, McKenzie, sorry.
But he, Tillinghast did all the courses around New York.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
Wingfoot.
Okay, yeah.
And
yeah.
I mean, he was prolific.
Yeah, sorry.
And he and Ross were just real good buddies.
Okay.
You know, it's just even beyond that, we've had Ron Force in here recently to look at stuff, and Andrew Green's been looking at stuff. So even to this day, it's just best in class. You got to take care of this thing. We're just caretakers of a very historic place. Let's not screw it up.
Yeah. Right.
So we don't let members go out there and realign the layout.
So even that, when you redesigned number 3 last year, it's not just a, hey, we're going to redesign number 3. There's a couple of years, if not more, of like diligent work on, hey, we want to maintain the integrity of the golf course, but maybe we've also realized that with the growing practices and kind of the cutting practices that we can speed the greens up so fast that it maybe has become not what Ross envisioned, or whatever you want to call it.
John, you're right. I mean, he writes that putting should not be a game of chance.
Yeah.
You know, and a bunch of the greens that are out there today in Ross courses, that's exactly what they are. And it's Andrew Green calls it pillowing, and it's 100, 125 years of stuff that you put on the greens.
Right.
And that's when you get these turtleback greens that were never envisioned by Ross.
Yeah.
And I guess if they were rolling five, you could probably still play them okay, right. But they're impossible at 11. Today's speeds.
Absolutely.
So many great Ross courses in the area have taken to this. Charles River, Braeburn. There's been a lot of time looking at it and adjusting these greens to try to get them back to what Ross wanted.
Yeah.
Make them bigger.
Yeah.
I think people thought it was sexy to have smaller round greens, but that's not what was designed, and you end up with less pin placements and less interesting experience.
Right. Mm-hmm. My brother's course, so we've talked about this before, is Cohasse Country Club. So that's in Southbridge, and it's a nine-holer. And it's a very unique 1918 Ross design, but similar thing. Like the greens, I love good short par threes. Like they don't all have to be 225 yards, which is kind of what you see on tour now.
Mm-hmm.
Those types of things where these guys are hitting five irons. T-Mac, me and you are hitting five woods or three woods.
But,
you know, like
number seven at Silverado.
Yeah, like the 140, 145 yard, which I think is like number 15 here. I think that's an amazing golf hole. It's just arguably the signature hole for the course just because of the view and where it's at and the lake. And it's 148 from the back tees, I think, depending on where the flag's at. But it's just such a great hole where you can change pin positions, wind direction factors in. It's a downhill hole. So you got a lot of factors coming in. 14 coming back is 185 yard tough hole coming up the hill with an impossible green,
right?
Arguably, when you get it at green speed. So the fact that he went back to back with, and the reason I bring all that up is that Mark's course, Cohasse Country Club in Southbridge, number three is 185, 190 yard par three going up a hill with a really difficult green. And number four is 130 yard par three. Really cool back to back. Yeah. Yeah. So
what, when we were analyzing the course to try to tell the story of a journey across Oakley, it is amazing the thoughtfulness Ross put in. I mean, you hit every point on the compass with our greens. I mean, he was just so adamant. He didn't want to see boring parallel fairways.
Right.
And just, and he did it on 85 acres. It's absolutely mind-blowing how we put this course together on this little tiny property.
Shoehorned it in there.
With 1900 technology, not with, you know, scopes and gradients and figuring out computer animations. Like that's the
other thing I'm amazed about over there, Dan, is that he did all this, you know, before the time of you know, what the technology that we have today. And, you know, how many years did it take? I mean, 11 total, or did he just kind of tinker around with one hole or a couple holes? I mean,
there were three major renovations.
Okay.
And any pressed the membership, and the membership responded. I mean, we bought a steam shovel for the 1907 renovation.
Oh, wow.
And that, not many people did that. They were still working with a team of horses in most courses. So He wasn't bashful about asking for toys.
Yeah.
So the three major renovations, and so 1910 was the last one, and we're landlocked, and I think that was part of the move to Essex. I mean, it was just going to be maintenance from there on. He couldn't do anything.
Yeah.
He had done his work is done. You know, no complaints. He did us right.
So bring us to 1998, because I think that's an unbelievable story about his granddaughter showing up for the 100-year celebration.
Yeah.
Right?
Yes. Miss Pippett, Mrs. Pippett, she came. Dr. Shea reached out to her. She was living in Vermont. And I have the correspondence, and it's absolutely fantastic. What a delightful woman. I didn't get a chance to chat with her, but the fellows that did kept records. And certainly this correspondence, she just was such a lady. and still had a memory of Oakley and spoke how her father will forever be grateful for the start that they gave him.
Right.
And she said he always maintained friendships to the end with many Oakley members. But so she comes down, and God bless her, she brings a check to pay for the evening, right? And she's like, oh, yes, right?
Oh, my gosh.
And I have a letter where she's, what was that? Oh, Dr. Shea is sending the check back to her, and it's a copy of his letter to her, right. And then her response, what did you do? I'm supposed to pay my way.
Gosh.
It's just that old Scottish, pay my way kind of philosophy. But she spoke a great deal with a bunch of our members, and the thing that my takeaway from so many of those conversations is that she said, I never saw my dad when I was growing up, when we were in Pinehurst or when we were in a little Compton. And the message I get from that is that he was always on the road. And there's a bit of a controversy out there, with 430 courses, how could he possibly have ever, seen them all? And so there's actually some people have theorized that he saw and was active with a third of them. He might have visited a third of them once or twice and sent Hatch, who was his right-hand guy, to do some work. But they speculate a full third of them are just tabletop designs. And that last part, I just can't wrap my head around it, spending so much time researching him. And Dr. Healy's the same way. We're like, you know what? I don't see this guy putting his name on a lot of courses that he didn't have intimate knowledge of. Oh, wow. And the fact that she said, she never saw him, the fact that if you look at where his courses are located, they're clustered.
Yeah.
And they're always near a railhead. Mm-hmm. And that's how, obviously, travel happened in those days. So it's certainly conceivable that he could have gotten to all these, certainly the majority, far more than just 60 or 70% of them.
No.
So
makes sense because the Ohio courses he did,
yeah,
Scioto, which is where Nicholas grew up, was like unbelievable.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, he's got a bunch in Michigan. He's got North Carolina, a ton in North Carolina.
Oh yeah.
So that's a good point.
New Hampshire,
yeah,
there's a cluster, and we already talked about Rhode Island. So
yeah.
Yeah, so that was our thinking, and it was built up a little bit by her, but it was such a treat for us to have her here, and I think she passed in 2000, so it was very fortunate. She was in great spirits. She wasn't infirm at all.
Right.
Wow.
That's great.
Wow.
Wow. Sam, I think we were pretty blessed to have this one, right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. My only question to you, Dan, is that I know that he did two designs for Oakley. What did he happen to with the one that you guys did not, the Oakley didn't accept? Did he ever do anything with it? Did you guys hang it on a wall, or did that just get kind of lost with time maybe?
Well, I'll tell you, I didn't know it existed.
Okay.
Until Bradley Klein does his award-winning book on Donald Ross, and he has the wrong design in his book. Oh. And I'm looking at it saying, what is this guy doing? That's not our course.
Research.
And
crazy.
Anyway, he corrected it in his subsequent editions. But that we were blessed. Most of our history and artifacts were destroyed in the 1962 fire that just consumed the old clubhouse.
Hmm.
And so we didn't have really many old records at all.
Yeah.
Then about 20 years ago, someone stops by, and it was a descendant of one of the early secretaries of the club.
Okay.
That found all these board minutes in their attic. I mean, they're all written in cursive. I mean, this is gold. 20 years of board minutes.
Oh, historians, treasure trove.
1920. I mean, just gold.
Oh, my God.
And I don't know if you've ever read cursive. I mean, we all were trained in it, but it's hard to read. And but we have a historical committee here, and we'll sit around this table and maybe there's some adult beverage in the room, but maybe not. At any rate, you get to read them, and we've read through them all.
Yeah.
and just some wonderful finds.
Yeah.
And wow. One of the biggest ones was people, including some well-known authors who have written about Ross, have said, you know, Oakley is not, this 1910 course has been altered. It's not a Ross course. Wow. And the big criticism is the transitions between green to tee box are all very consistent, except for 7 and 8. And we found in the minutes on May 15th, 1910, the board voted to order the grounds committee to lay out 2 new holes, 7 and 8, according to plans by Donald J. Roth. In the minutes.
There you go, right?
There's proof.
It was so awesome.
Oh, yeah.
That's
validation, right?
Basically,
right. Yeah, validation.
So, you know, that helped us understand, fill in a lot of the pieces that we didn't understand previously.
That's such a find, like you said.
Oh, man.
Absolutely. Wow. I don't want to keep him too long because he's already spent enough time with us, but I really appreciate you coming over, Dan. And it's
yeah, Sean, glad we... Tim, you guys are great. Yeah. Spreading the gospel about golf, and
yeah.
As you can probably tell from my comments, this is a topic I'm pretty excited to make sure people get straight. You know, our role and in the real importance of Ross to this club,
right,
and a lot of our membership.
Well, like you said to me a couple weeks ago, like we've got a historical society and we don't want to keep it under wraps. Like we want to spread the word and tell people about it. So
absolutely,
whether this becomes part of the Oakley, you know, history or whatever, but I think it's a great way to expose, because there's so many new members. I mean, obviously I've only been in for 3 months, but there's so many new members. It's kind of changing the membership. You get some guys who've been here for a long time, but there's a lot of people that don't know what they don't know,
right?
Bottom line, right? They just think it's either, and the hats, I don't know if you've seen them in the pro shop that we just got in. I designed them. I did use that Brandon Bills company, Tim, that I did in, down there south.
Oh, okay. Great company. Yeah. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. So on the front of the hat, I put the original Ross. Like, that was what I made sure that I put on the hat, because I wanted to make sure people understood,
right,
that it was the original Ross design, you know, his golf course.
That's cool.
I think it's something to pay homage to. And my next round of hats, I'm going to put Strawberry Hill on part of them, or just something to kind of keep. And Oakley, by the way, is spelled L-E-I-G-H in the estate version. I don't know if I get in trouble with maybe using that. We'll see.
Maybe some copyrights infringements there.
Yeah.
I'm not sure.
A lot of,
okay.
Toes to step on.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I'll.
That's great.
Tying
the history into those things is important.
I'm glad.
I'm glad you're doing that.
Yeah. Just don't lose it.
And just like you said, spread the gospel. We've had a lot of people from the Donald Ross Society reach out to us. They know we wrote this book last year.
Good.
And it does fill in those 10 years better than anything that's out there. And Tim, I don't know if any of your listeners, if they have an interest, I know they have a few of these still here. They could reach out to the club if they want to acquire one. I don't know how they're handling that, but.
Great.
Yeah, is that how our listeners could get more information on Donald Ross and designs and all that good stuff? Is there a society, or what website should they go to, Dan, or where should they go?
They should probably just go to the Oakley countryclub.org and get the phone number and to just call over, and whoever answers could guide them.
Yeah,
great.
I think the pro shop has them too.
Yeah. We'll get people interested, we'll get them in their hands. Let's put it that way.
Absolutely.
So. No, that's great stuff, man. I'm excited, Tim. This was one I was really looking forward to doing. And I really, again, appreciate Dan. Appreciate you coming in and talking about it. And thank you for letting us do this.
Yeah. You guys are great.
Yeah.
Thanks for the opportunity.
Yeah, good stuff.
Yeah, thank you, Dan. Thank you for the historical preservation that you're doing. Great work. Thank you so much for being on the podcast. We certainly appreciate it. And I'm really hoping we can get you on again, because I think there's a lot more history we can dive into even more.
We just went to 1910. We got to go from 1910 to 2024. So
I know. We got 100 years still to go. I can't wait. Part 2 coming up. Yeah.
100 years.
Great stuff. All right.
Thanks, Tim.
Thank you. Thank you, Dan. Have a good one.